Morning, everybody. Welcome to Don't Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. We're sponsored today by Red Lanyards. Get your red lanyards. And today we're joined by a very, very, very special guest, Arvin Hickman, who is news editor of PR Week.
Hello.
Welcome.
It's a pleasure.
How are we?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well. We had a big win yesterday, didn't we?
We sure did. But yeah. I've been told that you're not necessarily a Liverpool fan.
I don't know. So Liverpool, obviously the team I support and I've supported for many years. We're actually in the Club World Cup Championship.
He's an Arsenal fan.
2-1 yesterday. So it was great. Really, really big
fantastic
win.
Night. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm sure you were out celebrating like
I've been celebrating most weekends this year. Yeah, it's been really, really good.
It's been really easy.
Jules, you wanted to talk about
why you cut me off? That's nothing Tottenham to fan. Do with
Tottenham Arsenal. Fan. Yeah, I'm proud. We've got Mourinho.
It's not been that good in North London, has it? Really?
No, it hasn't. Not at all. But yeah, Tottenham and Arsenal fans.
But you had something on your mind, didn't you? Because you, in the office, you were talking about campaigns that have flopped and campaigns that we should give props to.
Yeah, so we were just having a bit of a chat. We always do this. Things crop up on Twitter or whatever, and we drop them in the group chat and see who jumps on it first. Sometimes total campaign flops. Other times we've seen some real successes. We brought both to the table. We're going to be looking at some of the flops and why they flopped and how they could have perhaps been done differently.
Yeah. The one that you showed me today, the Pelican...
Peloton?
My man said Pelican.
Oh, man.
We're keeping that one. That one's staying in. That one is staying in. Pelican.
Peloton. Because I'm actually not super aware of them. Mm. I wasn't.
That's one of the more recent ones because it's a Christmas ad. So, yeah, that was Peloton. I didn't even know they existed as a brand until they flopped.
Yeah. Have you seen it, Arvin?
Yeah, I saw it on the train on the way down here. Mm. It's an American ad, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can tell.
Yeah, but just it went that viral that, like, people, you know.
I mean, basically, the premise of the ad is their husband gifts his wife one of these Peloton, they're like cycling machines, where you basically look at the screen and there's like an instructor person that eggs you on and stuff. And just the way she reacts to it. When you look at this ad, it kind of looks like a modern version. If you remember one of those really old school ads from the 70s and 80s, where like your housewife would get a vacuum cleaner and she'd be really excited because she gets to clean the carpets and with a nice new vacuum cleaner. That's what it kind of reminded me of when I saw it. It's like a modern day version of this. And it just felt a little bit like old fashioned, a bit clunky and not really that inspiring.
Do you know what? Before thinking that it was antiquated and just kind of steeped in a lot of regressive ideas about women, I just thought it was just crap. My first thought was this is a really bad advert.
Yeah.
We were saying earlier there's other ways to do it. Like, I feel like the premise, like what they were trying to do was say, here's a guy encouraging his woman to be fit and to achieve her goals or whatever. But as Undy said, it's like, what really indicates that that's what they set out to do? Like, where is that context? And it comes across, you know, we were saying like, there's a lot of pressure on women to stay fit, to not let themselves go, to always bounce back, and even when you've had a child and you know your whole body's changed, to like carry on looking that way, and like all those things don't really get touched on in the videos. So it's just like very dodgy grounds. Like maybe a way they could have done it differently is if maybe she's training for something like her first half marathon, or you know, she wants to learn how to ice skate, and then he's encouraging her and to achieve those goals, and he's being a supportive partner, but unfortunately it just didn't come across like that.
You know an advert is shit or really good if something comes from it, and if someone makes like a remake. So I think someone showed us Ryan Reynolds' remake of that advert with the same actress, and basically she's in a bar with two of her friends, and because Ryan Reynolds has a gin company, and so she's in the bar with two of her friends and she's just like looking really depressed because she's broken up with this boyfriend because of it, and she's drinking his gin, and it's got like millions of views on YouTube. But like that is what they should have done themselves to respond to their own shit advert. It's pretty terrible. But all their adverts are pretty terrible, to be fair. I've seen another one, which is
bad. How do you sell like a spinning machine, really? I mean, it's not really something that you go out and just buy, like, you know, as a normal Christmas gift, isn't it? I can imagine they're not very cheap.
No, they're over 2K.
They're not very practical.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I don't know how you sell that. How do you spin it?
Do an advert like that. That's the advert.
Like a drum roll sound effect.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know, because I know you've got some examples to hand of a few other complete and utter car crash moments. But what I'm interested to know, again, just coming back to this whole idea about representation in the workplace and diversity of thought, diversity of people as well, from kind of a variety of different walks of life. How has an organization supposedly as big as this company managed to sign off on so many different levels a video that is just literally littered with so many cliched and antiquated ideals?
It's a good question. And you have to wonder, you know, the agency that they've employed to create the ad, you know, what's the sign off process there? What creative teams are actually coming up with the ideas? Is it the client that's saying, no, actually, we just want this really boring ad of this lady getting excited about spinning? Or is the agency misguiding him? I don't know, is the honest. I don't know much about Peloton as a company.
And what happens to the agency? Because they're always going to want work. Well, that's the thing.
What if there wasn't an agency? Do you guys remember that Pepsi Kendall Jenner?
So that
was created in-house by Pepsi, and you can tell. And this could be a similar situation, but we just don't know.
That was another big flop.
One thing I'm really interested in, especially from like a PR week kind of like industry expert point of view, is when we say it's a flop, often we're talking kind of like socially on Twitter, people are, the sentiment. And like, I'm always really keen to know and find out like what is actually the negativity in revenue and things from all of these people, because I can't, like, I've drank Pepsi since that advert. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, I've gone to H&M since they had a t-shirt that said coolest monkey in the jungle with a young black kid. I went to View Cinema to watch Blue Story. So like, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. But I mean, it was accessible cinema.
Was it a good movie, by the way?
Let's get on to that. We'll get on to that.
Big up Ratman though, you've smashed it anyway, regardless. But yeah, so like how often do brands actually see negative revenue in bad adverts?
They do, if they're really bad flops, they can see a definite dip in revenue. They can see a dip in their share price. I think one of the things about this ad, and I don't know if it's just the ad that caused this, but I think it did cause a significant dip in the share price. Or at least it's been
1.5 billion.
That is a failure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you can just blame the ad for that. That there could be other things around the campaign that might have contributed.
Yeah.
There might be other bits of bad press. But those are the sort of metrics that you would look at to work out the overall success of a campaign.
So I used to work at L'Oreal. And around that time, they had Monroe Bergdorf, the whole like shit show, to be honest, of bringing her on board with a campaign and then firing her because she had tweets surfaced of, you know, her being kind of like anti-white and pushing anti-white propaganda, and they fired her. But like, over a certain period of time, really and truly, sales are pretty much the same, and if not going up and increasing. And I think,
which specific brand are we talking about?
So like L'Oreal Paris Cosmetics.
Yeah. Okay.
So the specific makeup brand of L'Oreal Paris, the consumer goods company, like, side of things, they obviously did that campaign, 23 other ambassadors, and then they fired her, and still sales kind of like revenue continues. And I'm always really interested to know where, sometimes I feel like, are certain brands and agencies purposefully missing the mark because they know they're actually going to get share of voice, and ultimately in a few years time that share of voice might translate to more sales.
I don't know. I know what you're trying to say, but I don't necessarily think negative publicity in that way is a good long-term strategy, really. But I think what you find with some brands, especially big brands like L'Oreal, Nike's another example.
Yeah.
You remember the Colin Kaepernick. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of people who actually didn't like that in the US. There were videos of people burning their Nikes and stuff like that. So it was definitely a bit Marmite. You know, some people loved it, some people didn't. But actually, the good sentiment led to more sales than the downside. So you can still measure those things. But I don't think as a tactic you would go out and try and piss people off, especially your core consumers.
Sure. That was a thing that we were speaking about earlier, is kimono. Kim Kardashian came up with some shapewear line. But this is where people were saying that maybe she did do it on purpose, because obviously, I mean, she is the type of person who like could easily have just gone, Kimono. But basically what ended up happening is she pissed off everyone in Japan, and they're not really her buyers. Like, they're not really. Yeah. So, but what did happen was it got everybody talking about cultural appropriation. It was on the front of every. All of a sudden, everyone knows she's got a range, and people didn't really know she had one. Mm. She didn't really know it was in the works. They didn't know she spent millions branding
the woman for cultural appropriation.
She really is.
Every year,
but at the same time, something. That probably got her more money. Like, I mean, chances are, because who did she piss off? The Japanese. That's you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, she's known for being a cultural appropriator anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, what maybe
other
some
examples
publicity.
Do you have?
Well, I mean, I think one of the worst ones, and I'm thinking you guys might have touched on this before, was the Chicken Boxes campaign that came out of the Home Office.
Yeah.
So basically, just to let our listeners know, it was a campaign that was trying to target knife crime, and they ran messages of people on chicken boxes, and I think the mindset behind it was, you know, let's target the black community in London, and where are they going to hang out? You know, the old trope, they'll hang out at chicken stores. Mm-hmm. But this received a massive backlash. You know, one of my mates who works at Manifest, which is a PR agency, basically described it as a single cynical campaign more concerned with aesthetics than actual change, solely founded on the racist notion that chicken is the best way to communicate with black folks.
Yeah.
I think that did a lot more damage than actual good, and I can't understand how nobody within the Home Office and also their agencies would look at this and think it was an appropriate way to target people.
Mm. Well, I can confirm I've been knife free since that campaign, so.
it might have worked on you.
I'm joking. No, we've obviously done, you know, we responded to that campaign out of pure like shock, similar to what you're saying, that it actually went out really. But I think one thing we found interesting is the campaign itself, what do you think? I'm asking the question. Is the campaign itself a bad campaign, or is it that it comes from a voice of the Home Office and the government, who then, when you look historically, they've had massive cuts to youth services at the same time, so they're spending £60,000 or £80,000 on chicken boxes. If it had come from a different brand, let's say like a Link Up TV or a GRM Daily, do we think the same reaction would have happened?
It's a good question, and I do also question that myself. I think the fact that it came from the Home Office, and you had, you know, someone like Priti Patel who was out there and basically responding to it, I think that definitely did fuel the backlash, especially when you consider that, you know, the Conservative Party over a long period of time have been cutting the number of you know cops on the streets, and all these things are contributing to it. So people are rightfully questioning whether this is the right thing to do. So I think part of it is that, but I think part of it is also the execution and the sort of channel that they used and how they delivered their message. Mm. I don't think there's anything wrong with the message itself and using those stories as quite personal stories to try and reach through to young people. I don't see any problem with that. Mm. I just think it's the way they did it, and the fact is, if they're not going to back up these sorts of campaigns with extra resources into policing and other sort of community things, then it feels a little bit sort of like fake almost.
Yeah, and hollow.
A bit hollow, yeah.
I think with regard to what you were saying, if it were an organization or a company that had a perceived interest or invested interest in inner city kind of urban kids from your big cities like London, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, wherever these issues seem to be pervasive, I think there might be slightly, at least initially, a blowing over of the insidious nature of the campaign. They might be like, oh, these, because people tend to, I find, they tend to link the historical grievances that they have with an organization and poor execution and say, you guys are cancelled, we don't like you. But when it comes from somebody who, as I said, has kind of a vested interest in those communities, sometimes people forget that the execution is poor. And don't necessarily try to come to terms with the fact that, oh, actually, is this leading us in the wrong direction? Which I think personally, well, I think we all think the same because we embarked on our own kind of mini campaign around it. But I think it is a very dangerous sentiment to put out there into the world.
Well, let me throw this one back at you guys, actually. I'm quite interested to hear what you think. If you had to run a similar campaign with similar messaging, how would you deliver it? What sort of avenues or channels do you think would be more appropriate?
We were working with Prince's Trust, who reached out to us because of the work that these guys have done, where they took the chicken boxes back to the Home Office. And essentially what they were saying was, we would really like to co-create with some young people. Could you source some people who've been affected by knife crime? And so we can work with them to create a program that will then get rolled out. And caught up with the guy who was running the initiative yesterday, and he was saying how amazing it was to hear stories from the people themselves. But then also to hear their questions on what this is going to look like when it gets rolled out. Like, what's their safeguarding like? What areas are they going to... They're like, you have to go to the source when it comes to these. I reckon it's going to be successful. You know, this is what we want to see. We want to see people co-creating, engaging, and not just preaching and you know, antagonizing.
Do you know what I think? Top down education is absolutely vital, and seems a bit cliche, but the reason I say that in this instance, if we were given a big wad of money to, you know, run your own campaign, the thing that I find very interesting is actually what tends to happen when it filters down to young people who live in these communities that are affected by these prevalent social issues, is that they in turn begin to internalize the rhetoric and believe it themselves. That, so I actually spoke to a couple of young people who were like, yeah, this is actually quite cool. Like, you know, I can read on boxes stories of kids who've handled a knife. And in a way, there is something quite positive about that.
Sure.
But my takeaway as an older young person to maybe a 12 or 13 year old who's reading that is, I think that this is doing them more harm than good. And maybe that's just my own sentiment. But actually, if we were, the reason I spoke about education at the top is, if the raw data and facts were put out in the public for young people to see, for the public to see, regarding serious youth violence, then there wouldn't, a lot of these kind of old tropes and ideas about knife crime wouldn't be so pervasive. For example, the idea that it only affects, you know, black and brown kids and men in this,
exactly,
in London, it just isn't true. The idea that black on black violence exists just isn't true.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but these things aren't really, these aren't the prominent kind of discourses that we're having. We're actually talking about, oh, why are black kids so disproportionately affected? Why is a knife the choice of weapon for all of these kids? Why are these kids all carrying knives? I've had people in my community killed by guns. You know, it's not an issue about choices of weapons. Actually, you get to a point with a lot of young people whereby after a series of knuckle fights and fights with all kinds of tools, that they're like, do you know, actually, it's going to take a knife this time. It's not just suddenly like you wake up and you go into your mum's kitchen and you pick up a knife.
Yeah.
And because the messaging around these issues is so one-dimensional,
it's focused on the knife,
and so focused on the knife, the narrative just becomes so monolithic and so tone deaf and one-dimensional.
On that note, you ran some insight. I wasn't working with you guys at this time, but I read about it on the website, where you, after the Grenfell disaster, you guys ran some insight. So what was happening was, I think it was Channel 4 reached out to you and said, like, how do we go about making content here? And you guys ran your own insight to find out what people from the community actually wanted to know, wanted to see. And maybe you could tell us what you found, which I think is a big part of counteracting this narrative, is like, what are the narratives that are, you know, a lot of the time it's maybe more helpful to highlight the positive.
Well, yeah, I guess around that time, media organizations were just working out ways that they can respond to the travesty, really. And I think they came to us saying that they wanted to produce a certain style of video. And, you know, being from near that area and both of us having friends from around the area, we were there anyway. And it was very, very quickly we understood that actually no one wants to speak to the media. No one wants the media around. Like, there was this kind of rhetoric that a lot of fake figures were being put out about, you know, sensitive information about the number of people who died. And, you know, people really didn't trust the media at the time. So,
you know, when you think about what happened recently with Jacob Rees-Mogg coming out and basically saying, you know, why did they listen to the authorities? You know, anyone with common sense would have just run out. Yeah. You can understand why people are so pessimistic about the media and don't trust them at all.
But it's not just that. I think what I found really interesting about that was the fact that then you guys said, so, okay, well, what would you want to see? And they were saying positive representation. Like, there's a million, there's an amazing community effort going on, loads of initiatives. And you know, what was it, the concert that you guys ended up covering?
Yeah, there was so much, like, it was, do you know what, it was the first time that in this country I had actually felt a sense of community, that like there is still communities who come together and work together for like a common good. And that's the problem. We weren't really hearing that. We were hearing all of the negative things. We were hearing about the demographics of people who were in the tower. We were hearing about who the cladding was. We were hearing about the fact that this wouldn't have happened if people didn't put 8 people in a room. How, like, A, that's flipping insensitive. Yeah. And B, like, there is a lot of community efforts going around to fix this problem. So we covered a grime fundraiser which was going on, that was put together by a group of young musicians in the local area. Initially it was going to be a Notting Hill Arts Club, and on the day they said that they couldn't do it because of capacity reasons. So they decided to put it on an skate park. So we just followed that, and you know, from that we ultimately, Channel 4 were the only major broadcaster to cover that the fundraiser, apart from BBC Newsbeat, and obviously that we were the ones who filmed it and produced it. But very simply, it just came from hearing from that target audience what they want to see and what they want to hear.
Co-creating, and I listening, think, yeah, running
and,
inside.
And that's the problem with the Home Office one, is that the government talk to young people and run insight, but they don't act upon it. And the only insight that they acted upon was that 90% of chicken shop demographics is under the age of 24. So they were like,
and you do also have to wonder, are they actually listening? What sort of research are they asking? What sort of research are they carrying out? What questions are they asking?
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, what? Because the thing is, I'm sure that a lot of their research would have told them that a lot of, I don't know, 12 to 16 year olds are, we would actually see, exactly. Like, and for me, it's almost the equivalent of, you already have an agenda in mind and a narrative in mind that you want to push, and you just want to substantiate it. Yeah. So, and it's very easy to have data that's skewed.
You're asking questions that lead to that conclusion. Yeah,
and it's kind of like what, you know, massive news organizations, not yourself, obviously, but massive news organizations, maybe like, I don't know, like a Good Morning Britain, do when they bring on a particular guest who's going to have a particular narrative. So Piers Morgan can be like, I told you we need more police on the streets to combat black kids killing each other. Aren't they all killing each other? Let's get on, I don't know, some black guy who speaks for the whole black community, who's like, yeah, of course. It's a massive issue, and of course we need to have more police on the streets, and of course we need to the black community needs to speak to themselves about this issue and tell each other off about it.
It's not easy getting the insights, though. I think it was you were saying that there was a campaign recently that they said it was going to flop. They ran some consumer insight.
That was the IKEA Christmas one, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so apparently when Mother tested the campaign idea, it flopped.
That's interesting.
Supposedly.
My question was, who were you asking?
That's the problem. That's it. And then they went with their gut and then ran the campaign.
Because we spoke about it when it came out. These guys, they turned the computer around and were like, the computer, the laptop, the PC. and we're like, what do you think? Like, flop or like success? And I said, I looked at it and I kind of went, instinctively, I just said, like, flop. And you guys know we really, really like it. And I was like, I don't know who he is. I don't know. You're like, we like it because he was an artist from a decade ago. They had not gone with the trend. Da, da, da. So, like, I feel like if you'd asked me, I would have given you one type of insight. If you ask people who are actually in touch with that culture and are a part of the demographic, I guess, then you might get a different answer. It's like, who are you asking? Someone educated who knows, you know, who knows a bit more about grime than I do. Yeah, it's grime, isn't it? I'm pretty sure it's grime.
It was IKEA's first Christmas campaign, at least in this country. And what was really clever about it was it was so different. And it was a really clever way to sort of promote IKEA furniture and sort of tap into one of those, you know, really Christmas anxiety, I guess you could call it. You know, having to host people, that sort of stuff. Everybody goes through that. Everyone who's ever hosted a Christmas party goes through that similar anxiety. And it was just a really clever way, I thought, to sort of, you know, let IKEA furniture save the day in that sort of environment. Yeah. And I love the use of grime in that as well. I thought it was really cool.
So they did good, but Serie A
Oh, oh yeah.
Julia, you're Italian.
Oh, no. I was hoping we wouldn't have time for this.
I'm glad we're dropping this one in because Julie is indeed Italian. Mm. So Julia.
the whole of Italy.
What the fuck is going on, mate? Got,
so we're joined by Italian spokeswoman.
Someone Italian else tell, set the premise. So someone else, yeah, set the scenario. What happened? Okay. Because I'm not a football, I'm not.
So the Serie A, which is the sort of Premier League in Italy, if you like, they used to be, you know, the best league in the world, the full on slightly worse times. But they've always had they've always kind of had a racism problem, haven't they? Especially with fans making racist chants. Quite a number of really famous players, Mario Balotelli, former Liverpool player, who now plays in Italy. You've got Romelu Lukaku, who now plays in Italy, Koulibaly, the Napoli defender. You know, just this season, they've had monkey chants thrown at them quite audibly. And, you know, some have come out and said this is unacceptable. It's, you know, made headlines for all the wrong reasons. So this week, Serie A launched an anti-racism campaign. And one of the executions for this campaign was commissioning an artist to, I don't know how to describe this, to basically paint three images of monkeys with war paint on their faces.
And different eye colours.
Different eye colours, yeah. And it was like...
So what is the messaging behind this? What is the desired messaging?
Well, they were saying... We are all monkeys.
We're all monkeys, yeah. Right.
Because this is something that was a campaign that was actually, this is actually a rehash campaign. Yeah. So there was a We're All Monkeys campaign that happened 5 years ago. So 5 years ago, there was a We're All Monkeys campaign that came off the back of, I guess, another ubiquitous race storm that was happening in football, as it seems to rear its ugly head every few years now. But you had footballers like Luis Suarez, who had been engulfed in his own race storm years before. Luis Suarez, Lionel Messi, Philippe Coutinho. I don't want to throw
Marta,
anybody under
Marta
the bus.
Was in that as well.
Yeah, the Brazilian footballer Marta. And then you had like Gary Lineker coming out on Twitter and supporting the campaign. And in this campaign, these footballers were linking up and taking photos of themselves eating bananas, saying, "We're all monkeys." And I think the point at the time was that they were attempting to subvert the narrative and maybe ridicule and satirically ridicule this idea that black people are monkeys historically.
Was it the execution, do you think, that failed? Or like, is there literally no life in that concept?
The thing that's interesting, there's no life in it. The thing that's interesting to me is that now, 5 years on, people are now, I guess, looking back on that and saying, what the fuck were we thinking to allow that campaign not only to live and breathe, but to actually become, to like pulsate through our social kind of avenues. It was completely permissible back then. And do you know what? I don't even remember having such a big problem with it then as much as I do now. And it's such an interesting insight into our kind of social psyche and how we can retrospectively look back on things and say, bloody hell, we really got it wrong. Yeah. Even like when we spoke about the Soccer AM thing, when you look, there was like a video that came out recently of an old Soccer AM series. For those who don't know, Soccer AM was, and still is, I think, a show on Sky Sports, which is kind of like a entertainment football discussion show, and it used to have Helen Chamberlain and Tim Lovejoy on it as presenters. But they used to do this quite like sexist segment of the show where they'll invite like kind of sex, you know, soccerettes.
Oh, okay, well, I think you're gonna say Richard Keys,
women, you know, women, female football fans coming in like mini like skirts.
That's a huge part of Italian culture.
Yeah, so that still happens in Italy now, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. But on every show, not just on the sports, but
right. So what was happening? in this Soccer AM one is they would invite these ladies on, and then the interviewer will ask the ladies, hey, how old are you? And they'll be like 19, and then a group of guys in the back would go, great age, fantastic age.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was happening consistently.
This was normal.
Completely normal. This is honestly, but this is like 2009, 10.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not. This isn't.
I think
stuff
the
so correct like
segment
so
stopped
antiquated.
Around like 09, 08.
Right. Yeah, okay.
09, 10
but this is
maybe.
This is stuff that was happening in the last decade.
Yeah, exactly. Roughly
the last.
I think we
10
can all
years.
Agree that you know things have moved on quite considerably since then. You've had Me Too. You've had Black Lives Matter, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, what I can't understand about this is they've tried to reclaim the whole monkey trope, right? Which is deeply hurtful and offensive. But they've sort of done, you know, a bunch of white men has decided this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I've not reclaimed it. Do you know what I mean? I don't know other black people that are trying to reclaim the monkey trope.
How can somebody who's never had that trope thrown at them try to reclaim that trope on behalf of other people?
Let's reclaim it.
Reclaim. Reclaim the colour pink.
Do you know what, though? Back to what you were talking about with the old We're All Monkeys campaign and this one. I think the difference is that it seemed to be from individuals, that one, right? Whereas I think what is so alarming about this one is that it is Syria A who have chosen to do it, who also haven't taken any action on the previous bits of racism that has gone on from the clubs. Yeah. So, like, they've... I don't know, chuck £20,000 fines at clubs for racially abusing a player. And then they're like, all right, do you know what? Let's roll out a however much thousand campaign to stop racism by also kind of depicting the issue as being the fact that they're monkeys, but we're all monkeys. Though, do you know
what? This goes back to what Haya was saying, is like as an Italian, then fine, I've got a little contribution for you. We haven't moved on. Like, we haven't moved on when it comes to feminism. We haven't, like, they've not, Me Too movement in Italy is not a thing. Like, we're like one of the, we've got the highest domestic abuse men against women rates in Europe. Like, you know, we've still got Socceretts, but like, on everything, like even to this day, if you ask a woman in Italy what her ambitions are, like what career, like she could tell you, oh, I want to be a show. Like here, that doesn't happen. I want to be a showgirl. Oh, I want to get my tits out on TV. Yay! You know, hashtag Me Too, hashtag careerism, just not a thing.
Is it the same with racism though?
They're just. I feel like I don't know. There's generally a concept. Like a conception of Italians as arrogant, and I feel like this is filtered down from our position, and to some extent the British Empire had the same effect on Britain, that we're very arrogant, we think we're the best, like we think we're the best at everything because we do fashion, we do cars, we do engineering, you know, we had the Roman Empire, but that was all ran by men. Like it was built by white men, and I feel like we're as a society still feeling women, migrants, they're still feeling the repercussions of that history, whereas the UK is getting to a better place, I feel, because it's more diverse. Like, we are not as diverse in Italy. Like, we are not having those conversations. We're not engaged in it, you know? Our media is run by a fascist, so...
Yeah, well, that's true. I feel part of the problem here is, a major part of the problem here is the people who are coming up with these ideas and the people who are signing off on these ideas, clearly they're not consulting people from the communities that it affects. There is no diversity in thinking or thought or even consideration. And I think this whole... you know, scandal could have been easily averted if they just decided to consult the very people who were impacted by it. Yeah. And they've got plenty of great footballers from these backgrounds that could say, hey, you know what, this monkey thing's probably not going to go down too well.
I wonder what would happen if they were like, Mario, what do you reckon about this?
I think there's a piece of content there somewhere.
Mario, like throwing darts at it.
What do you reckon?
Right.
It's incredible.
Oh, dear. Whether they'd even listen, though, who knows?
So what does that mean now for us as people in the positions that we're in? You know, I guess it's kind of like final thoughts.
Well, I think the important thing for the industry and for brands to consider is actually thinking about what your goals and target audience are and actually making sure that they're represented in the process, in the creative process and ideally in the sign-off process as well. Because if you have that diversity of thinking from the very start, from coming up with the idea, and that filters through into what the people who sign off on it think as well, then I think a lot of these things will be averted and you'll actually have far more impactful campaigns that resonate with the very problems they're trying to solve.
Mm. Interesting.
Preach. I like it.
Preach indeed. Preach indeed. So just speak to the people that it's relevant for.
That's
right?
It.
But properly, not don't come with leading questions.
Well, that's right, yeah.
You know, what do you how good do you think this monkey campaign is?
It seems so obvious, doesn't it? Just speak to the people it affects. Like,
I know we were just having closing thoughts, but just maybe as a closing question is, And in a way, you can kind of bat away this question, but I think something that is difficult for these organizations that are trying to tackle historical systemic issues that they have is resource and time. Even for us, sometimes when we're wanting to create content that speaks for a particular community, and we were started by two black men, you know, we've been fortunate enough to take on more staff and have more hands and have a more diverse crowd, but we still need more women. We still need more women of color. We still need, you know, an organization that is reflective of London, whether that's to do with race, thought, class, disability, sexual orientation. Like, that is an aspiration for us. And because we don't have those things, does it mean that you don't tackle those issues and leave it to until you get to a point where you have an organization that is reflective enough to be able to have the correct insight to deliver on tackling those issues? Or do you attempt to tackle it and get it wrong, but still seem to be tackling it? Because I think what's happened with Serie A, even though I know with them it's different, you could have just asked Balotelli and Kalidou Koulibaly and Romelu Lukaku, you literally could have just asked them how they felt about it. But the issue is, when you've got your backs against the wall and there is a whole heap of pressure and animosity towards an organization because they're not being perceived to be tackling an issue, often these companies are like, right, we don't have the resource to do something spectacular, we do want to
show we're be seen addressing it.
I see what you're saying, but I think in the case of Serie A, I could be wrong here, I almost think there's a bit of an arrogance there. It's almost like, well, let's just do some tokenistic thing to try and look like we're tackling the issue, but we don't actually really care. Right. It feels a bit like that. I think in some other organisations, yes, there could be a lack of resource. But, you know, there are agencies that specialise in this sort of thing. There's no excuses. And if you think about your consumers and you're not representing them in your marketing teams or in the agency support that you use, then are you really targeting them effectively? And I think businesses need to be very mindful of this in this day and age.
I think it just comes down to if you care or not, like you said. Like, I mean, because if you don't have the resource anyway, you can find ways of not necessarily outsourcing, but you can find ways of temporarily adding the resource. For us, we care, right? We care about representation. We've always cared about representation. So we've been mindful of the fact that we are two black boys from London who have started a business. Yeah. So because we've been mindful of that from the beginning, we've always sought to kind of bridge that gap without necessarily having the resources to be able to do that by going out into the community and asking people, speaking to people, becoming personable with all of the list of communities that you've mentioned. With Serie A, they obviously don't care because the resource seems to be available.
Yeah,
they clearly haven't used the resource, and even if it wasn't available, it would be very easy to.
It's not just Serie A. I think, you know, football in Europe in general, led by UEFA, they just don't care enough.
Let's not be holier than now about this. In England,
it happens in England too. Let's be honest. You know, there is racism still in the terraces in English football games.
Yeah, that's always my. I know we're wrapping up, but that's always my problem about when there's racist abuse in like Montenegro and you've got all the commentators being like, yeah, you've just got to see that, you know, this is ingrained in their culture. It's ingrained in our culture too.
That's right.
So absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Red Lanyard, in association with Liverpool Football Club, who I support.
Yep,
and thank you, Arvin, for coming on our podcast.
Thanks for having me.